Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It's Monday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day. One day you see it, another day you don't. Enola Gay, Tuskegee Airmen, Japanese Americans from the decorated 442nd Regimental Combat Team. What's next? All are related to the scrubbing for diversity, equity, and inclusion. We continue to talk about the economy. Consumer confidence is slipping. We check in on the Hawaii Retail Association. How are small businesses faring with all this uncertainty? We circle back with a hula dancer from Oahu who tells us what's it like to be in the latest Cirque du Soleil show in Waikiki. Plans are underway to build a new voyaging canoe, Micronesian style, and an anime convention draws thousands to Honolulu. We hear from two Japanese stars about the business of voice acting. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Across the country, there was a call to stand up for veterans and rally at state capitals on Friday. It was just getting underway as a Honolulu Civil Beat column flagged that the U.S. Army website had scrubbed a page detailing the story of the 442nd, the most decorated unit of World War II, composed of Japanese Americans. The news did not sit well with one veteran, retired Lieutenant Colonel Matthew McCarville, who stood on Baratania Street with about 100 others. He seemed stunned at the news.
442nd, particularly the 100th 442nd, one of the proudest units in the Army. Young officers, young enlisted men should learn about them. Our citizens should know what they accomplished. It's just a disgrace.
And you're wearing an Army hat.
23 years in the Army, yeah. Four of them here at Schofield Barracks.
So that must hurt, though, knowing they're erasing part of that history off the web, for now, anyway.
Well, it is for now. This leadership, this too shall pass. The pendulum will swing. The history of the 442nd will be back up on an Army website at some point.
That was Matthew McCarville, retired Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army. Some members of the Hawaii Congressional Delegation pushed back on the web scrubbing. Representative Ed Case fired back at the Army Secretary asking about the omission, and Representative Jill Takuda began circulating an online petition. But before the weekend was over, the Army republished the webpage. Honolulu resident Delani Boucher had this to say about the need to support our veterans.
I'm very disappointed in what's happening regarding veterans and supporting veterans. My father was a veteran, 20 years U.S. Navy. He was also a Republican, but what my father used to tell me about it, the Republican Party, I don't feel like this is the Republican Party anymore. It's not my father's Republican Party. So anyway, I'm here to protest what's going on regarding veterans today. I was here for the women's one and the LGBTQ one a week or so ago, and now I'm here for veterans. I just don't like what's going on, especially with Hawaii, scrubbing Hawaiian, Filipinos, Japanese, it's just terrible what's happening because that's part of our culture here. We're a blended culture here.
And what do you think about the news that the Army has scrubbed the 442nd history off its website?
It's terrible. It's crazy. It's like, how can you erase history like that? And they also did that with the Tuskegee Airmen. I heard that they put that one back up. I don't know if they did, but I think they need to leave their hands off of all of our history, because we don't want to repeat our history that happened like 80 years ago. And that's what there's a lot of stuff going on that's making you kind of harken back to those times in history. So everybody read your history. We don't want to repeat it again.
That was Delani Boucher expressing her desire to help support our veterans as the new administration moves to downsize the federal government to cut waste and reduce the growing budget deficit. Later this month, we will be honoring veterans who fought in the Vietnam War. The congressional delegation says also on the calendar for this month is the dedication of the new Daniel Akaka Veterans Home in Kapolei. We are told the 120-bed facility has about a half a dozen private pay residents, but it's still awaiting certification from state health officials and the Veterans Affairs Department in order to begin accepting Medicaid and Medicare patients. That blessing is set for a week from Wednesday, but it's unclear if the cuts to the VA could delay that process. The delegation has been asking since the administration has indicated it will lay off 83,000 VA workers. It's unclear how Medicaid and Medicare could be affected. The White House has said it will not cut benefits and is focusing on fraud and waste, but concerns remain about how the reduction of force will affect services to the most needy. The economic outlook is shaky with our volatile stock market and the uncertainty of the tariffs looming with some of our key traders. Following our call-in show last week with State and University of Hawaii economists, we reached out to the Retail Association. Tina Yamaki says members are nervous as they are trying to plan for the hike in minimum wage set to go up to close to $18 in January. We talked to Yamaki this morning. What are you hearing from your members about, you know, consumer confidence and what they're planning for?
It's kind of day to day what's going on. We never know when the tariffs are going to drop, what new tariffs are going to be out there. Our guys are really worried, especially the smaller local businesses. They're not just dealing with tariffs, and tariffs deal with anything from building goods to medication to apparel, all of that kind of stuff. And then it's come January, you have the increase in minimum wage, and they're trying to figure out how are they going to pay for that, including the increase in all types of health insurance, because Hawaii is the only state that mandates that we provide health insurance to our employees. And then we're looking at some bills at the legislature, and some people are saying, you know, it's only another $50. Well, if you don't have $50, your alternative is either you're going to close your doors or shut some of your hours down or maybe even lay off some employees.
We know that the lawmakers set a schedule for the minimum wage hikes.
It's still a substantial increase that a lot of our local retailers can't afford that right now. They're struggling. They also have a lot of their loans from COVID has come up now, and you know they need to start paying that off as well.
Yeah, talk about that. We just marked the 5-year, you know, milestone, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, not everybody's a whole yet.
And people think, you know, with COVID, out of sight, out of mind. But for a lot of retailers, in order to keep their doors open, to keep their employees employed and getting a paycheck, they took out second mortgages on their home. They took out loans. They did all kind of stuff. And now they got to start repaying all of this stuff, or some got deferred payments, some, you know, even with their lease rent and stuff. But all of that is coming to a head now. And so they have to pay that on top of higher minimum wage, higher shipping costs, higher costs for goods. And so at the end of the day, they're looking at things you have to pay, which is taxes and employee payroll, employee benefits, all this other kind of stuff, you know, merchandise to stock your store with. And at the end of the day, the question is, how do you keep your doors open? Because they don't have like a mainland sister or something that they can depend on. Local businesses are just here in Hawaii.
And, you know, there may be lease rents. And then I don't know, you know, how many of your members are still recovering from the Maui wildfires?
A lot of them still are. So some of our members lost one store, some lost up to 4 locations, and they're still trying to rebuild. And unlike homes where you just have one insurance you're dealing with, there's multiple layers when you're dealing with businesses a lot of times. So some of them are still working with their insurance companies. Some of them are looking at, do we want to rebuild in Lahaina? When can we rebuild? What's it going to look like? How much is it going to cost us?
I don't know what you've got planned. Are you reserving your members, you know, just given the volatility at the moment, you know, with the stock market and, you know, with the tariffs? Consumer confidence is really shaky right now.
So according to the National Retail Federation, a lot of consumership has been down in February. And like you said, everyone's kind of waiting for that shoe to drop, and they know the tariffs are going to increase a lot of prices. And especially with, you know, workers not being at the farms and things like that, and the weather, everything's going to go up in price. The question just is how much, and how much can we afford?
And with the reduction in force, I'm sure families are pulling back because if they don't have solid employment, if they've been laid off or they fear they may be laid off, they're going to spend less.
Yeah, they're really, it's called target shopping or list shopping. They have a list of items, and that's the only thing they'll purchase when they go into a store or a mall. Whereas before they might, you know, have impulse buy by the register or, oh, I could use this and just put it in their basket. Now it's really looking at what they really need.
And what about the retail merchants that, say, are tied to tourism? Because we're hearing lots in the headlines about the Canadian tourists, you know, rethinking their vacations.
We used to have a lot of snowbirds from Canada that used to come to Hawaii for 3 to 6 months out of the year, and we're hearing we're not seeing them. So it's a double-edged sword, because the visitors go and shop in our stores, and then if they're not coming, maybe the employees' hours are reduced or they're on call now, so they don't have that income to go shopping, you know, as much as they used to. So it's kind of hard. Hawaii is so dependent on tourism that it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. If the tourists don't come, we can't have a harder time selling things.
I imagine, too, when you're ordering merchandise, if you don't feel confident that you're going to move these things off the store shelves, you're going to order less.
Yeah, and right now, people have already started ordering way ahead for Christmas already. It's not like you put in an order and you get it in 2 weeks. A lot of times, orders are ahead of time, so it's just hoping that they can sell it, that they didn't order too much. And that's the whole wait and see thing. And now, since the pandemic, it's very different now, too, whereas before you had 30 to 60 days to pay your invoice in. Now, a lot of manufacturers or distributors are like, if you want your merchandise, you got to pay up front before we deliver.
Really? So that's the trend right now.
Yeah. So it's kind of changed. It's not all of them, but we're seeing more and more who have done that since COVID time, and they just kept that trend going.
Anything else you want to add just about the tariffs, you know, whether it's from China or Mexico or Canada?
People don't realize that we get a lot of fruits and vegetables from Mexico because Hawaii imports mostly everything. So a lot of our fruits and vegetables, a lot of manufacturing items come from Mexico. Same thing with China. We have such a large Asian population that a lot of Chinese goods, you know, whether it's food or shoes or clothing or whatever, that is also imported in from China. And a lot of manufacturers are in China that companies use. So that's going to have a huge impact. And with Canada, they have a lot of petroleum. So it's not only our cars, but it's also the delivery trucks. That's going to go up the gas for that. And you know, you have other things that they also supply. People are now starting to look at the packages to see where things are coming from and realizing that, you know, their chicken nuggets or their Nutella or some of these other things actually come from Canada. So they're looking at a price increase for that.
Anything that you're telling your members at this point as we get through this first quarter?
We're just kind of holding tight and looking to see what happens all over the world. It's not just happening in Hawaii. It's a nationwide thing that's going on right now. And we're also starting to see recession popping up in other countries as well. So we're just kind of bracing for it and trying to get ahead and plan as best we can.
Well, Tina, we certainly appreciate you carving out some time for us today.
No problem. And be sure to check out the National Retail Federation website. They have a lot of information.
That was Tina Yamaki of the Hawaii Retail Association, who we talked to this morning. We were discussing the uncertainty in the marketplace with the trade wars and softening consumer confidence.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
As a nonprofit statewide broadcaster, Hawaii Public Radio is always exploring different ways to serve you. We've compiled highlights from the last year in our annual report. It's an opportunity for you to see what HPR has been up to and an opportunity for us to thank our community of supporters, including you. Download HPR's annual report at hawaiipublicradio.org/report.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
You know, we wanted to take a moment to share some of the feedback we've received on our recent shows. Listener from the Big Island, Gus, sent us a note following our call-in show with state economists Eugene Tion and Carl Bonham, executive director of the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization. Gus writes, "It makes me sad to hear your answers to our economic problem. There is an equitable solution. Grow hemp." He also left us voicemail.
Gus here over on the Big Island. Why don't we grow hemp? Why don't we, you know, make plastic bags on the Big Island and put people to work, blue jeans, so much other things that we could do in all the areas that we grew sugar.
You know, and after we spoke with Dennis Sale and Kiara Lacey about the German Film Festival that took place this weekend in Honolulu, we received this delightful voicemail about the word doppelganger.
Aloha, my name is Jeremy Levine, calling from Lahaina. Listening to the report about the German Film Festival, and the gentleman said that as far as he knew, there was no word for doppelganger in English. Interestingly enough, there's not just one word, there's two, both ancient, as is doppelganger. The first is a word that nowadays we use as an adjective, weird. When used as a noun, you're weird is your doppelganger. The second word is a fetch, very Saxon word. And your fetch is a doppelganger. And much of the doppelganger can come and get you and bring you perhaps to your death or somewhere. A fetch will come and fetch you. And the fetch is also a doppelganger. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. We appreciate the feedback. If you have comments to share, write to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And in advance of the conversation live this Friday at the Kahilu Theater in Waimea, we'd like to invite you to leave a voicemail with questions for our guests, Patrick Hart or Dr. Billy Bergen. Call 808-792-8217 to ask them your question. We might even play it during the show. Awana, the Cirque du Soleil show in Waikiki, is holding auditions for hula dancers today until 2 p.m. Now, the show is more than 100 performances into its run, and we thought we'd check in with one of the performers to see what the experience has been like so far. Mahealani Kamau is originally from Oahu, and she says she's been dancing since she came out of the womb. She was performing for Disney in Florida when she found out that she had been cast in Awana. She spoke to The Conversation's D.W. Gibson about performing in the show and reconnecting with home.
Has the show settled into place, or is there still some fluidity in terms of what happens, say, week to week or from performance to performance?
There definitely is both elements. It has settled where we're all familiar with how the show runs and all the different acts and how it goes. And then at the same time, there's still that fluidity because we need the flexibility if a dancer gets hurt or if an acrobat gets hurt or if we can't have a certain act. They have times when artists or the acrobats can sit out and watch a show and then we modify the show for that. So there is still that fluidity and still the creative process happening. They're going to change the opening soon. It's a combination of what we've done through the creation time, that 6-week creation before the world premiere, and then what we're doing now, and we're just combining it.
What does that look like in terms of that change that you see for the opening?
It would include more of the dancers. It would bring us out from the beginning. We do have one dancer that is part of the opening in the beginning. This would just have all the dancers to come out right in the beginning and just introduce us and sort of establish that Hawaii relationship from the start.
When changes come in because of an injury or because someone wants to try something new with an opening of the show or something along those lines, how does that feel as a performer? Does it make it harder to sort of be responsive to those changes?
In a way, it's exciting because when you're doing 2 shows a night, 5 days a week, over and over, it can sometimes get monotonous. But when we're throwing those curveballs, it kind of makes it exciting. And then it helps us to be able to get back in that creation and figure things out like right on the spot and to do it. I don't know. It's exciting, I think, for me, not as challenging or as difficult as you might think it might be.
There's something unique about live performance in that, as you said, on the one hand, it's the same thing every day. You're going out there and you're doing the same thing every day. And there might be a challenge there in terms of making it fresh. But on the other hand, it's never the same, right? Because the audience is never the same.
Yes.
And so there's something different about the energy in the room every time you go out there, I would imagine.
Agreed. Yes. When we had an audience that was majority of children, the energy was incredible from the beginning to the end. And it's the same with adult audiences. It just depends. And sometimes the earlier shows, they're more a little more energetic. And then the 8:30 show after dinner or drinks or whatever, they're a little more sleepy. So it's a different energy with every audience. So yes.
Did you get to interact with any of the kids after they saw the show? They can be brutal critics, you know.
Yes, they loved it. I mean, just hearing their reactions through the show, just talking with them after too, they were all very, very excited and happy and loved the show. We talked to the Kamehameha Children's Chorus. That was one that we got to do a meet and greet with. And they're actually on the track, singing on the track. And I also used to be part of the Kamehameha Children's Chorus when I was in elementary school. So it was so neat to have them and to just see their bright eyes and their happy smiles and just grateful for them, but not brutally critical of us.
Good, good. I'm glad they were there for you. Talk about what a routine looks like for you. Where does the process begin for you in terms of getting ready to do the shows?
So I get to the theater around 3:45, 4 o'clock, start my makeup. Before, it used to take me 3 hours. Now, with all the practice, it takes me about an hour to do. I'm ready by 5. I get dressed. They do 15-minute calls, 30-minute calls, 45-minute calls to let us know when the show's about to start. We have a circle time that we do with the dancers and some of the other acrobats or whoever wants to join in with us. And we have a little pule time where we just ground ourselves and remind ourselves of the kuleana and what we're there to do. And after that circle time, we start the show and the show goes on 5:30. Then we have our break from 7 to 8:30, about an hour and a half to have a small light dinner. And some of the other acrobats, they continue to train through the break. And then we do the 8:30 show.
Well, and the show, the stage itself is nice and big and high ceilings and a wide open space in which you perform. But I've had the pleasure of going backstage and seeing that it's not quite as spacious back there.
Oh, yeah.
No. Talk about some of the sort of challenges of sorting through backstage and what you do with your time when you're not on stage during a performance to sort of keep in the mindset.
Oh, man. So as you can imagine, there is a lot of traffic in the back in those small hallways. Everything is timed. Everything has to be safe through the creation process. Oh, my gosh. There's so many people involved to make sure that everything runs smoothly in the back. We have the costumers. We have 3 stage managers. We have a coach. We have PMed. So they're all there to make sure that everything runs smoothly in the back. It is tight, but we all make it work. It's like if you have to be on stage left, you have to be there because otherwise you'll be running into everybody else. We just have to keep up with the timing of when we have the breaks, when the trickster is out, when we have time to change. We're changing our costumes. We're touching up our hair, touching up our makeup, doing things in the back. The acrobats, they have to some shower in between the acts because one does a water bowl. So there's all kinds of things going on, but it's really just keeping to our tracks that they set out for us and that we worked out through the creation process to make everything move smoothly in the backstage. Yeah.
Sneaking in a shower between acts. Who knew, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot goes on. They have, yeah, we do maybe as the dancers, we change our costume. We have a base costume, but we change maybe 6 times through the show, different skirts and stuff. And different accessories.
So I bet I could give you a precise time on any given day and you would be able to tell me exactly where you are in this sort of puzzle making backstage.
Yes, actually, yes. It has to be very precise. Otherwise, like I said, we'll be running into each other and it'll be a big mess. But yeah, everything is organized and set for us.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, every now and then facing injuries or things of that nature. Have there been dancers that have had to leave the show so far, or is the core group stayed there in place?
No, the core group stayed there in place. We just have vacations and lives outside. Some did get injured or sick. So, of course, we'll need backups for that. When we started the creation, it was just us, just the 8 dancers, 4 female, 4 male, and no backups at the time learning the show. So all the 100 shows were really on the core dancers to pull through with that. But again, we've worked out contingencies where we do with 7, how we make it work.
And the show's working to get some of those backup dancers to spell some of you. I'm sure that will be a nice relief.
Yes. Yes, indeed. It will be.
And you mentioned, you know, a life outside the theater, outside the show. Hard to imagine as so much of your energy, I know, gets taken up by the show. But talk about what life looks like outside of performances. Do you have another job that you do? What does your life look like outside the theater?
Yes. So I'm actually a single mother of 2. So that's always a full-time job. And then I also work as a realtor for Nakoa Development. It's a Native Hawaiian development. That one's for-profit. And then we just created a nonprofit called Aina Ho'opulapula. And we help beneficiaries to build on Hawaiian home lands. So I do that during the day. And then I'm at the show at night. I do many other things. I wouldn't say it's a job, but I do work on the lo'i. I farm. I fish. I do a lot of sustainable practices that our kupuna or Hawaiian ancestors did. It was like when I moved home, I wanted to be back home and really like get back into the roots and get back into the dirt. So I do that. And then real estate has helped me also being able to help the Hawaiian people.
Adding up all those activities sounds more like 30 hours in a day. I don't know how you squeeze it
yes.
all in. I know that there's so much reverence culturally for hula. But I'm wondering about the economic side of things. And you spoke to that there in terms of maintaining another job. Are the other dancers, as far as you know, maintaining day jobs as well? Are some of them able to just simply do the performances in terms of making ends meet, economically speaking?
Oh, no. The other dancers have other jobs. One is a flight attendant. One works in the hospital. The others have other shows that they dance in, many other production and entertainment companies that they dance for. While I would say the circ pay does help to support, we... Living in Hawaii, you always need kind of a cushion or a safety job to fall on or just extra income to have a savings.
Is there anything you can tell us in terms of the pay scale, like how much you guys get paid or if there's a process for sort of bumping up how much you get paid over time?
I would say that for myself, this is the highest paid contract I've had for the pay here in Hawaii for a hula dancer. It's really, really good pay. They do take care of us and they do value us as artists. Some of us got a full 18-month contract and then some got part-time contracts or like 6-month contracts. I do believe that we are able to negotiate. And initially, we were able to negotiate our rates when they first offered us the contract for Circ. So I do imagine that when that 18-month comes up and if the show continues to be a success, then I think there is that room to be able to negotiate for a higher pay or more.
Good. We'll keep the fan base notified so we can make noise on social media
yes,
to make sure
please.
You get all you deserve. Well, anything else you'd like to share with listeners about the experience you've had doing this show?
My thing is I hope that everybody who comes to see the show, you know, gets to take a piece of what we are there to show them. It's really just the collaboration of people of all different cultures. We have the acrobats that are international, and then we have us as the home and the connective tissue to the host culture of Hawaii. I just want the audiences to take that home. It's so rewarding, and it's so, I don't know how to, I get chicken skin when we have locals in the audience and we hear the chihus at the end and they give us the standing ovation because they've seen all the shows that have come through Hawaii and everything. And to get that kind of response from the local audiences is really rewarding. And then for the audiences who aren't from here, who can appreciate and who can understand, because the whole show is in our native Olelo Hawaii. So even though they don't necessarily understand what's being said or what's being told, from meeting with other audience members who aren't from Hawaii and they still appreciate and they still understood the stories we were portraying, that is like the best thing and the most rewarding thing for us to have. And so that's really it. I just want audience members to come here and enjoy and then to feel a part of our ohana and our stories and what we're doing in Waikiki to resurrect those stories and to bring light and love and life back to Waikiki, because it's been kind of run over by, you know, tourism, the hotels, and everything, and our stories got lost and what is the foundation of that place. So yeah, that's really what we're there for.
Well, thank you for taking some time today to come and talk to us about it, and good luck with the rest of the shows.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mahealani Kamau talking to the Conversations, D.W. Gibson. Kamau is a hula dancer in Cirque du Soleil's Auana at the Outrigger Beachcomber Hotel in Waikiki. And full disclosure, Outrigger Hospitality Group is an underwriter of HPR.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing on Maui to help break the cycle of poverty for residents experiencing homelessness, such as HomeAid Hawaii. NereidHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Clay Risen describes a political movement which destroyed the careers of thousands of teachers, civil servants, and artists whose beliefs or associations were deemed un-American. His book, Red Scare, is about post-World War II America, but he says there's a through line connecting that era to our current political moment. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
We have been celebrating the Hokulea's 25th anniversary with the many events put on by the Polynesian Voyaging Society this month. And today, HPR's Cassie Ordonio joins us to talk about efforts to build a new voyaging canoe in the Micronesian style. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we're pretty familiar with the Hokulea, but what makes a canoe Micronesian style?
It depends on who you ask, actually. So for Hokulea, you see like this large double hull canoe. But for the Micronesian canoe, specifically the Satawal style canoe, it's a single hull canoe. But still, it's smaller than Hokulea, but larger than a six-person outrigger canoe.
Interesting. Yeah. So you were able to talk to one of the Satawalese navigators.
Yeah. I actually spoke to Thomas Rafipi. He's been navigating since he was actually 2 years old. And he says voyaging and canoe sailing is a way of life on Satawal Island. And Satawal Island is actually a coral atoll located in Yap State in the Federated States of Micronesia and has a population of about 500 people. So a small island. But the folks, they depend on voyaging to kind of sustain their island where they go out to fish, and also establish connections with other islands such as Chuuk. And they even sail as far as Saipan, which is about 500 miles away from Sarawak Island. But when I spoke to Thomas Rafipi, he got the idea to build a canoe actually a couple years ago. So a couple years ago, he was doing some canoe lashing for his friend's canoe hale on Hawaii Island. And he was asked to do the canoe lashing, which is like an art form that they do in Sarawak Island, because they like the style of their lashing. It's very decorative, very sturdy, very strong. A lot of Micronesians, especially in Sarawak, use like coconut fibers to kind of help tie the canoe all together. And so that's when Thomas Rafipi had the idea. It was like, okay, maybe we should teach the younger Micronesian generation to learn about lashing and canoe sailing. And so about a couple years ago, he and his friend invited about 30 Micronesian youth from the outer islands of Yap and a couple adults to actually like do the canoe lashing. And he noticed that there's actually a lot of interest there. So that's what gave him the idea to build the canoe. And Rafipi says this canoe that's planned to be built in August would be a bridge to connect Micronesian kids with Native Hawaiians and other local kids on the Big Island.
I just want the local kids, the Native Hawaiians, to, or any other kids from Hawaii that can get on it, that have anybody that has interest in it can come on. We can show them how we sail our canoe, how we operate it, and how we steer them. And I think it's going to be very, very fun, interesting, and a lot of kids that are going to sail it, they're gonna find out that they're using all their senses, you know. In order to sail the canoe, you gotta be very keen to everything, your surroundings and the movement of the canoe, the waves and the winds.
Yeah, and you know, most people may not know that there are there's a generation of Micronesian youth who maybe have never lived on their home island, who were born here.
Exactly. So you see a growing diaspora from Micronesian kids from the Federated States of Micronesia, Palau, and even the Marshall Islands. So on the Big Island, you see a large generation of Yapis and Marshallese. Here on Oahu, you see Pohnpei and Chuukis. And then on Maui, there's a fair amount of Palauan and Pohnpeians over there and a little bit of Chuukis. Kauai has a little bit of some Micronesians over there, too. This canoe that he's planning to build is he's planning to use invasive albizia trees to build that vessel, which is the heart of the canoe. So on Sarawak Island, they typically use ulu trees, but for the invasive albizia trees, Rafipi says it's actually like a good wood once it's dried up, and it's very light, so it's easy to sail. For the actual sail, Thomas is also thinking of using pandanus leaves or lauhala leaves to build that sail. So when I also talked to Cecilio Railulupi, he's the navigator of the younger brother of Maupiailug, the late navigator who taught Nainoa Thompson. He says in order to sail or learn to become a navigator, it takes a village to help them and teach them.
It's your whole life learning, and you don't learn only from one person. You learn from everybody. You learn from your clan, your elders, even the ladies. You know, they talk navigation. You know, you listen to everything, so you absorb everything. And then when you start going out sailing, and then you just listen to what's happening on the canoe, observe the whole environment and the water. Sunrise, sunset, the moon, the stars, all of that. And then you're just confirming what you're hearing. You're just confirming and just keeping it to yourself. There are so many steps, many, many steps, and so many things that you have to go through, to especially your sea time, spend on the water, and seeing stuff, we call it epar, things that shows if you're on the right track, where you are, bereave, a fish, turtle, birds, even floating object in the water tells you if you're on track or off.
So Thomas Rafipi, in building this canoe, he's looking to source funding from the communities across Hawaii, and he's also looking to source funding from the Polynesian Voyaging Society. When I talked to Nainoa Thompson, who's the CEO of PVS, he said that it's a great idea and that this is kind of their way, PVS, to kind of give back to the Micronesian communities, because their master navigator, the late Maupiailug, was the one who taught him.
Yeah, because it's important to acknowledge navigation throughout the Pacific. specific. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio joining us today. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. More than 20,000 anime and manga lovers flocked to the Hawaii Convention Center this weekend for the 20th Kauai Con. In past years, about half of attendees have come from other states or countries to meet artists and cosplay as their favorite characters from books, shows, and games. It's estimated the annual convention generates more than $10 million for the state. Two of the voice actors who were in town for the festivities dropped by our studios on Friday. Sally Amaki is a voice actress in Idol, which is a professional entertainer in Japan. Kana Ichinose stars in the TV anime series A Mobile Suit Gundam, The Witch from Mercury, as Soleta Mercury, the franchise's first female protagonist. They spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender. Ichinose spoke through an interpreter. Suje Venkat Amaki starts.
I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California all my life. But I went to Japan to become a voice actor, and there was an audition that was looking for girls who would voice idol characters, like idol anime characters. So I thought it was an audition for voice actors, but it turns out that it was actually an audition for idols and voice actors. Like, you had to be both of them. Yeah, it's a really weird group. I'm still in it right now. It's called Nanabun no Nijuni. But yeah, so right now I'm a voice actor and an idol. By mistake. Yes.
Sally, for you, what is a particular role or character that you think people know you for or that might be your favorite?
I would say Kiriko from Overwatch.
You, Hashimoto, have preyed on this city. This neighborhood. These people. For too long. I have a message for you to take back to your boss. Kanezaka is under my protection.
My character, Kiriko, is a girl from Japan, and Overwatch has a lot of characters from all over the world, and you compete against each other, and there are so many heroes. One of the characters, Kiriko, is from Japan, so they wanted to cast a Japanese voice actor, so that's how I got the part. At first, they wanted her to have a Japanese-American accent, but I spoke perfect English. My character, Kiriko, came out in Overwatch 2, but her brothers were already original characters in Overwatch 1, and they had a Japanese accent while speaking in English. But the directors were saying that because Kiriko is like the youngest, it was more natural of her to have like perfect English because she probably adapted to the environment faster because she was young. So yeah, that was one of the directions. I first recorded her lines with Japanese accent English, but by the end, I redid all her lines in a normal American accent.
And did you modulate your voice at all? I honestly don't know how voice work.
Yes, it's a lot deeper than my normal voice. So one of the lines she says is, Kanezaka is under my protection. And she shouts a lot. And it kind of like breaks my voice a lot. So usually we would have 4-hour recording sessions, but it would end in 2 hours because my voice would be so sore by the end of it. So yeah, I kind of have to change my voice a lot for her.
Kana, same initial question. So what is a voice acting role that is your favorite or that people might know you for?
So desu ne. Kekko 2つ kurai, onaji kurai.
So probably there's two roles that I'm pretty well known for. One is from Mobile Suit Gundam, Witch from Mercury. And I play the main female heroine, Soleta Mercury.
そんなことしちゃダメです!
この水星の魔女の、スレッタ・マーキュリーに関しましては、ガンダムに
The character Soletta pilots a Gundam, which for if people don't know is basically a giant robot suit. And the difference in when she is in that robot suit and when she is not, she has quite a different personality. So for example, she is someone that is not too used to communicating with other people her same age. And she doesn't really understand human relationships, like as far as creating distance with people or how close to get to people. So, but when she pilots the robot, the Gundam, she is like very confident and she's like a very powerful main character. So I had to keep in mind the distinctions between when she's piloting the Gundam and when she's interacting with her classmates.
Sally, I wanted to ask you, because you've talked about this in interviews before, it's kind of one of your bits that you'll do with subtitles in some of your videos.
My YouTube videos, yes.
You'll be speaking in Japanese and then the English subtitles, you'll kind of play pranks on the viewers.
Yeah. So it started, all my YouTube videos have to get checked by my management first before it goes public. But when I first started making YouTube videos and I just like translated what I was seeing in Japanese into English, it was kind of like boring. Like it needed more spice to it. So I realized that none of the people on my management team spoke English. So I was like, maybe if I like, you know, write, I can write whatever I want or say whatever I want in English and it'll like, you know, slide by my managers and it'll go public if I write it in English. And so I started saying a lot of jokes in English and letting it slide by, and it just became one of my things on my YouTube channel.
I think there's something really fun there with you being bilingual and able to joke in that way, but also, I don't know, it's doesn't feel mean-spirited, but there is kind of that classic joke of what do you call someone who speaks two languages, bilingual, three language, trilingual? What do you call someone who speaks one language, American? So you're kind of making jokes of that English viewer.
Yeah, I definitely try making all my jokes about myself. I don't really want to like poke fun at anybody else other than me. You know, I just want the viewers to be able to relate to what I say and not feel hurt by what I say. So all my YouTube videos are basically self-deprecating jokes. Yeah.
Why did you move from Los Angeles to Japan, and what was that transition like?
So I wanted to become a Japanese voice actor. I know there's a lot of voice acting in American roles as well, but I just really loved Japanese anime. So I grew up in America all my life before I started this career, which was 7 years ago. And by then, I didn't really know how to speak perfect Japanese. Both my parents are Japanese, but I didn't go to any like Japanese school, so my grammar was terrible. So Japanese has a lot of different ways of speaking. And to your seniors, you have to use honorifics. But I had no idea how to use them. So the very first time I went into Japan and I took all these like auditions, because I look super Japanese, but my Japanese wasn't that good, they just thought that I was uneducated. So it was really hard at first. But yeah, halfway through, people realized that I just wasn't from Japan and they kind of got that. But I started learning Japanese, like the perfect pronunciation and grammar, through watching a lot of Japanese news programs and trying to like imitate what they were saying and how they were saying it. And yeah, after 7 years, I kind of got it. I don't know if it's perfect yet, but I'm trying.
I'm going to ask this question to both of you, but let's start with Sally. I want our listeners to really get that you both are famous. Like, you have a lot of fans. You are essentially, as an idol, you're basically a professional celebrity. Mm-hmm. And being women, being young women in that sort of role, I can imagine is tough. And so what would you say your relationship is with the idea of celebrity?
I have a pretty good relationship with my career and the people that support me. And I think that's because the very first reason why I started liking anime was because I stopped going to school halfway through middle school because I just like couldn't fit into
my classmates, and I just like couldn't make that many friends. And so I used to think that like everyone around me was my enemy. And I would usually, I went to a predominantly like white community school, so not many Asian people were in my class. So I would be made fun of for bringing like Japanese lunchboxes and stuff. So I was kind of ashamed of being Japanese, you know, of my culture. But after I started liking anime, it really made me accept who I was. And I don't know, the people that like my work are also the people that like Japanese culture also. So it actually makes me feel good, you know, like it makes me feel accepted because, you know, as a young girl, I didn't really feel accepted and I felt alone. So by becoming an idol and a voice actor and being supported all around the world for what I do in Japan is really amazing. And, you know, I want to go back to the middle school me and be like, you don't stop being you. And yeah, so I have a really good relationship with what I do.
Yeah, that's a really thoughtful answer. I appreciate that. Same question to Kana.
So definitely when I started doing this work, I didn't couldn't imagine that I would, you know, be known for my work worldwide. And especially being able to go overseas and meet fans like this. And I would say overwhelmingly, it is a positive feeling in a sense that if I get recognized for my work and I get to meet some of the fans, I take that energy back and it basically feeds into my career and allows me to succeed or motivates me to do even better. I guess one big thing I notice, especially when I come overseas to meet fans, is that fans overseas are very direct with their feelings and they're very honest. And they, you know, they make me want to go overseas again and to have more opportunities like this. And I know I just arrived in Hawaii today, but it's already such a wonderful place and I want to visit more places like this. So if you are hearing about me for the first time, please check out some of my work, some of the anime that I've been in, and I hope you enjoy it.
Is there anything else you would like to add? Sally, you can start anything else.
Honestly, I've always come to Hawaii for spring vacation ever since I was such a little girl. So I only have positive feelings towards Hawaii. And I'm super excited to be here this weekend. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope to come back already.
Anything you're really excited about doing while you're here?
I'm going to be shooting a music video here. So, and it's going to go up on my YouTube channel, so please subscribe and wait for the video.
And yeah, Kana, anything else you would like to say?
はい、そうですね。本当にここまで聞いてくださりありがとうございます。
Thank you so much for, again, having us here on the show, and thank you everyone for listening to me as well. And, you know, as far as my time in Hawaii, I haven't been here that long, but I already love it. And I know that I will love the rest of the weekend. I really want to go see the ocean, which we haven't got a chance to yet. So that we'll definitely do over this next few days. And again, thank you again so much for having me.
Thank you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, get out of here. Go see the ocean.
And that was Sally Amaki and Kana Ichinose. They spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender on Friday. And fun fact, Ichinose shared that her first impression of Hawaii when she landed at the airport was that she had no idea palm trees were so tall. Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear more about alternative media in our island state. What do you think about the state of journalism today? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. Find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.